Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English Listening Test. Ahead Books. Written by Sean Houghton. Test 5. I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I shall introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you will hear this sound. You will hear each piece twice. Remember, while you are listening, write your answers on the question paper. You will have 5 minutes at the end of the real test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. In the exam, there would now be a pause. Please ask any questions you have during the pause, because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part 1. You will hear 3 different extracts. For questions 1 to 6, choose the answer A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1. You will hear a dog breeder called Patricia giving a talk on animal temperament.
We're all familiar with Nanny from Peter Pan, perhaps the most famous fictional Newfoundland dog. And while fiction rarely syncs with reality, the Newfoundland's docile reputation around children is well deserved. However, that being said, I suggest you'd be ill-advised to leave even such a docile breed unsupervised around young ones. Indeed, I'd go so far as to say that's highly irresponsible. After all, every rule has its exception, and it's not worth taking the chance, even with such an instinctively well-tempered creature. Besides, a dog is only as good as its owner lets it be, irrespective of breed. The notion that buying a pedigree dog somehow guarantees a good temperament is highly flawed. In reality, even for the most responsive breeds, a lack of training can be detrimental to their behaviour. In that sense, no dog is low maintenance. They all require great care and attention and disciplining from a young age. But neither is it pure myth to suggest that some breeds are more predictable than others. Chances are, with proper care, attention and devotion, your Newfoundland will turn out the way you hoped. However, if it does not, you probably ought to be taking a hard look in the mirror. We're all familiar with Nanny from Peter Pan, perhaps the most famous fictional Newfoundland dog. And while fiction rarely syncs with reality, the Newfoundland's docile reputation around children is well deserved. However, that being said, I suggest you'd be ill-advised to leave even such a docile breed unsupervised around young ones. Indeed, I'd go so far as to say that's highly irresponsible. After all, every rule has its exception, and it's not worth taking the chance, even with such an instinctively well-tempered creature. Besides, a dog is only as good as its owner lets it be, irrespective of breed. The notion that buying a pedigree dog somehow guarantees a good temperament is highly flawed. In reality, even for the most responsive breeds, a lack of training can be detrimental to their behaviour. In that sense, no dog is low maintenance. They all require great care and attention and disciplining from a young age. But neither is it pure myth to suggest that some breeds are more predictable than others. Chances are, with proper care, attention and devotion, your Newfoundland will turn out the way you hoped. However, if it does not, you probably ought to be taking a hard look in the mirror.
Extract 2. You will hear an outdoors enthusiast called Donovan giving a talk about a traditional walking route.
The Camino is a very long walk which terminates traditionally in Santiago de Compostela in Spain, or for some, on the coastline beyond the city at a place known as the End of the World. Not only is the terminal point flexible, but so too is the departure point, with options in at least 3 countries. And again, sticking strictly by tradition, the starting point would actually be considered your home. It was traditionally a pilgrimage undertaken for religious reasons, but today religion has much less to do with it, and people of all faiths are equally inclined to go on this spiritual adventure. Flexibility exists in terms of pilgrimage length, too, with the only qualification to that being that if you want to receive the official certificate recognizing your accomplishment at the journey's end, you must be able to prove you have navigated the last 100-kilometer stretch successfully. The most popular route runs across northern Spain, though those looking for solitude would be well advised to seek out an alternative, such as the route starting in the south of Spain or Portugal. However, the caveat, if doing so, is to be mindful that these roads less traveled are also less well defined, lacking at times in appropriate signage, whereas you do well to even purposefully get yourself lost on the popular northern trail. The Camino is a very long walk which terminates traditionally in Santiago de Compostela in Spain, or for some, on the coastline beyond the city at a place known as the End of the World. Not only is the terminal point flexible, but so too is the departure point, with options in at least 3 countries. And again, sticking strictly by tradition, the starting point would actually be considered your home. It was traditionally a pilgrimage undertaken for religious reasons, but today religion has much less to do with it, and people of all faiths are equally inclined to go on this spiritual adventure. Flexibility exists in terms of pilgrimage length, too, with the only qualification to that being that if you want to receive the official certificate recognizing your accomplishment at the journey's end, you must be able to prove you have navigated the last 100-kilometer stretch successfully. The most popular route runs across northern Spain, though those looking for solitude would be well advised to seek out an alternative, such as the route starting in the south of Spain or Portugal. However, the caveat, if doing so, is to be mindful that these roads less traveled are also less well defined, lacking at times in appropriate signage, whereas you do well to even purposefully get yourself lost on the popular northern trail.
Extract 3. You will hear part of a radio discussion between 2 bee experts called Jenny and Keith.
If I had a pound for every time someone asked me after the welfare of the humble honeybee, I'd be, well, in exactly the same financial position I am at present, despite the fact that its status is becoming progressively more perilous by the year.
Quite. But it doesn't pull at the heartstrings in the same way as, say, our close cousins the apes, or elephants for that matter, the plight of both of which we seem to innately exhibit more empathy for.
Indeed. So this is why it is vital to make an extra effort to highlight their situation. The more glamorous causes, no less worthy or important, of course, tend to monopolise the headlines to such an extent that we could be forgiven for thinking that there are hardly any consequences to bees dying off at all.
Yes, of course, Jenny. Yet nothing could be further from the truth. Dramatically reduced bee numbers could have a devastating impact on the welfare of our indigenous flora.
Which is why it is essential, Keith, that we start to discuss ways in which we can give these little critters a leg up, so to speak.
Yes, quite. One of the simplest measures, given the irreversible loss of habitat which has occurred due to urbanisation, is to keep a wild flower garden. This can never compensate for the habitat lost, but it gives the bees more of a fighting chance. The added beauty of a wild flower garden is that it is also, by default, very low maintenance. That is why I am keen to highlight this method above all others, given the hectic nature of life today.
Quite. But for those willing to become a little more vested in the issue, you can also plant orchards or indeed maintain your own bee colony, both of which have the added benefit of providing a potential revenue stream too. If I had a pound for every time someone asked me after the welfare of the humble honeybee, I'd be, well, in exactly the same financial position I am at present, despite the fact that its status is becoming progressively more perilous by the year.
Quite. But it doesn't pull at the heartstrings in the same way as, say, our close cousins the apes, or elephants for that matter, the plight of both of which we seem to innately exhibit more empathy for.
Indeed. So this is why it is vital to make an extra effort to highlight their situation. The more glamorous causes, no less worthy or important, of course, tend to monopolise the headlines to such an extent that we could be forgiven for thinking that there are hardly any consequences to bees dying off at all.
Yes, of course, Jenny. Yet nothing could be further from the truth. Dramatically reduced bee numbers could have a devastating impact on the welfare of our indigenous flora.
Which is why it is essential, Keith, that we start to discuss ways in which we can give these little critters a leg up, so to speak.
Yes, quite. One of the simplest measures, given the irreversible loss of habitat which has occurred due to urbanisation, is to keep a wild flower garden. This can never compensate for the habitat lost, but it gives the bees more of a fighting chance. The added beauty of a wild flower garden is that it is also, by default, very low maintenance. That is why I am keen to highlight this method above all others, given the hectic nature of life today.
Quite. But for those willing to become a little more vested in the issue, you can also plant orchards or indeed maintain your own bee colony, both of which have the added benefit of providing a potential revenue stream too.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear a critic called Dan Fallon talking on a radio show about a film called The Man from Snowy River. For questions 7 to 15, complete the sentences with a word or short phrase. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part two.
So I would give that 4 stars. But now, moving on to the small screen, let's have a look at what's on television this week. And the first film I've picked out is a relatively old and little-known Australian movie, 1982's The Man from Snowy River. Now I say little-known, but that's not quite true. Indeed, until eclipsed by the release of the first film in the Crocodile Dundee franchise 4 years later, it was the country's most successful movie export. Besides, it also boasted a Hollywood heavyweight in the ranks of its cast, in the form of Kirk Douglas. However, 1982 was a very long time ago, relatively speaking, and I feel this film may well be lost to more recent generations of moviegoers. So I was very pleasantly surprised to see it appear on this week's TV schedule in a prime-time slot. But now to the film itself. This is a charming story based loosely on the famous Australian poem of the same name penned by Banjo Paterson. As mentioned, it stars Kirk Douglas, unusually in a dual role as he plays two brothers, Harrison and Spur. Alongside him is Tom Burlinson as Jim Craig, the film's main protagonist, not to mention Sigrid Thornton as Jessica, Jim's developing love interest as the plot unfolds. Berlinson and Thornton have excellent on-screen chemistry, and indeed the strength of the cast overall is unquestionably one of the film's great assets. However, it is neither the only nor the best one. More impressive still, especially considering when it was filmed, is the cinematography. Given the number of horses involved in the production, the challenge of scene shooting must have been immense. Yet the pans and sweeping shots of riders galloping their animals at breakneck speed over breathtaking yet treacherous terrain are spectacular and a very fitting tribute to the magnificent Australian outback itself. In case you hadn't guessed by now, this is a horsey story at heart. Craig was born and bred in the mountains, but is forced to leave and look for work in the lowlands after his father's passing. There, he carries the stigma of the mountain man with him and faces a lot of discrimination from some of the workers on the ranch where he finds a job, based on his roots. But life is not all bad on the ranch, and that is where he meets the owner's daughter, Jessica, with whom he quickly falls in love. The feeling is obviously mutual, and before long their relationship begins to blossom. However, not only are Jim's chances of winning her father's approval for the relationship with Jessica lessened by his poor social status and lack of means, there is a further twist to this tale. It involves Spur, Jim's good friend and fellow mountain man. The plot plays out this complicated web of romance very well, but undoubtedly its main focus is on Jim's coming of age. He is determined to prove himself the equal of his fellow ranchers, almost at any cost, and as the film draws to a hair-raising climax, he finally gets his chance. The film was so loved by people in its homeland that Berlinson was asked to reprise the role of Jim for the opening of the Sydney Olympics in 2000, a full 18 years after its release. It is a charming, heartwarming story with awe-inspiring mountain scenery, which, despite the presence of a Hollywood heavyweight in its cast, is unashamedly and unmistakably Australian, and always stays true to its roots. I strongly recommend that you tune in on Saturday evening and watch.
Now you will hear part two again.
So I would give that 4 stars. But now, moving on to the small screen, let's have a look at what's on television this week. And the first film I've picked out is a relatively old and little-known Australian movie, 1982's The Man from Snowy River. Now I say little-known, but that's not quite true. Indeed, until eclipsed by the release of the first film in the Crocodile Dundee franchise 4 years later, it was the country's most successful movie export. Besides, it also boasted a Hollywood heavyweight in the ranks of its cast, in the form of Kirk Douglas. However, 1982 was a very long time ago, relatively speaking, and I feel this film may well be lost to more recent generations of moviegoers. So I was very pleasantly surprised to see it appear on this week's TV schedule in a prime-time slot. But now to the film itself. This is a charming story based loosely on the famous Australian poem of the same name penned by Banjo Paterson. As mentioned, it stars Kirk Douglas, unusually in a dual role as he plays two brothers, Harrison and Spur. Alongside him is Tom Berlinson as Jim Craig, the film's main protagonist, not to mention Sigrid Thornton as Jessica, Jim's developing love interest as the plot unfolds. Berlinson and Thornton have excellent on-screen chemistry, and indeed the strength of the cast overall is unquestionably one of the film's great assets. However, it is neither the only nor the best one. More impressive still, especially considering when it was filmed, is the cinematography. Given the number of horses involved in the production, the challenge of scene shooting must have been immense. Yet the pans and sweeping shots of riders galloping their animals at breakneck speed over breathtaking yet treacherous terrain are spectacular and a very fitting tribute to the magnificent Australian outback itself. In case you hadn't guessed by now, this is a horsey story at heart. Craig was born and bred in the mountains, but is forced to leave and look for work in the lowlands after his father's passing. There, he carries the stigma of the mountain man with him and faces a lot of discrimination from some of the workers on the ranch where he finds a job, based on his roots. But life is not all bad on the ranch, and that is where he meets the owner's daughter, Jessica, with whom he quickly falls in love. The feeling is obviously mutual, and before long their relationship begins to blossom. However, not only are Jim's chances of winning her father's approval for the relationship with Jessica lessened by his poor social status and lack of means, there is a further twist to this tale. It involves Spur, Jim's good friend and fellow mountain man. The plot plays out this complicated web of romance very well, but undoubtedly its main focus is on Jim's coming of age. He is determined to prove himself the equal of his fellow ranchers, almost at any cost, and as the film draws to a hair-raising climax, he finally gets his chance. The film was so loved by people in its homeland that Berlinson was asked to reprise the role of Jim for the opening of the Sydney Olympics in 2000, a full 18 years after its release. It is a charming, heartwarming story with awe-inspiring mountain scenery, which, despite the presence of a Hollywood heavyweight in its cast, is unashamedly and unmistakably Australian, and always stays true to its roots. I strongly recommend that you tune in on Saturday evening and watch.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear a radio program in which two people, Anna Marr and Haida Gregory, are discussing La Palma as a stargazing location. For questions 16 to 20, choose the answer A, B, C or D, which fits best according to what you hear. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part three.
Welcome to Astro Weekly. Joining me on today's show are representative of the Tourist Board of the island of La Palma, Anna Ma, and astrophysicist Haida Gregory. Welcome to you both. So let me start with you, Anna. What is it about La Palma that makes it such a unique place for stargazing? Reputedly the best location in our hemisphere. Presumably it's got something to do with the famed Canarian weather?
Well, yes and no. Whilst it's true that, relatively speaking, we get more than our fair share of sunshine compared to most places in the world, some would say we are the poor cousin of the Canary Islands in that respect. The other islands boast more consistently clear skies. But believe it or not, the clouds play to our advantage. They're one of several factors which make stargazing here quite so special. Indeed, it is also the moisture in the air that gives our island such a lush and unique range of plant life, too, compared with the other islands, where greenery is perhaps in shorter supply. But that's a conversation for another day.
Oh, I see. Do explain.
Yes, well, if I could come in here. You see, there is a phenomenon called inversion, which basically means that the clouds tend to form a carpet of cover at around 1,000 metres. La Palma being the steepest island in the world, what this means is that above that altitude, and there is much terrain here at 1,000+ meters, the island is completely shielded from light pollution. That equates to perfectly dark skies, the ideal conditions for stargazing.
So it is necessary to travel to altitude to enjoy the starlit skies then, would I be right in saying?
Yes and no. On cloudy nights, the best opportunity for stargazing certainly exists at 1,000+ meters. However, in the complete absence of cloud, which is not unusual either, there are vantage points throughout the island, both at low and high altitude, which offer spectacular viewing. I guess the point to get across is that even under cloudy conditions, all is not lost here, which cannot be said of most places, and the clouds themselves can be advantageous, as already explained.
So the mountaintops are always clear, regardless of the weather at lower altitude, is that correct?
The vast majority of the time, yes. You see, the prevailing winds in this area play a part on forming the perfect conditions for inversion to take place. That means that for the majority of the year, conditions are very favourable. Occasionally, however, when the weather patterns change and winds come from a different direction, inversion does not take place below the tops, and clear skies are not guaranteed there. More often than not, though, conditions are favourable thanks to those aforementioned prevailing winds, the trade winds. So the likelihood of excellent stargazing opportunities at altitude is extremely high.
Would it be fair to say, though, that good stargazing is only possible away from habitation?
Yes, well, dark skies are essential, of course, so light pollution from towns and villages could be a potential problem. However, and this is another key factor which makes our island such a perfect astronomy location, the government has taken measures to ensure light pollution is kept to an absolute minimum.
Indeed. For example, white light is not used on the island. This is too intrusive. Lighting is required to be yellow or orange in colour. Furthermore, all street lighting, etc., points downward. This is a requirement by law, further limiting the extent of possible pollution. That is why, for instance, the area in the south of the island, around Fuencaliente, is an excellent spot for stargazing on clear nights, despite its low altitude and high population levels. Indeed, there is a huge tourist hotel at the southernmost point, yet you would hardly know it was there at all, due to the lighting policies on the island. Under normal circumstances, stargazing could not be enjoyed in such a location. But thanks to the government's commitment to maintaining dark skies, even densely populated areas of the island can make surprisingly good viewing points where they would not elsewhere.
Fascinating. And for our listeners, what tips would you give them to see?
Now you will hear part three again.
Welcome to Astro Weekly. Joining me on today's show are representative of the Tourist Board of the island of La Palma, Anna Ma, and astrophysicist Haida Gregory. Welcome to you both. So let me start with you, Anna. What is it about La Palma that makes it such a unique place for stargazing? Reputedly the best location in our hemisphere. Presumably it's got something to do with the famed Canarian weather?
Well, yes and no. Whilst it's true that, relatively speaking, we get more than our fair share of sunshine compared to most places in the world, some would say we are the poor cousin of the Canary Islands in that respect. The other islands boast more consistently clear skies. But believe it or not, the clouds play to our advantage. They're one of several factors which make stargazing here quite so special. Indeed, it is also the moisture in the air that gives our island such a lush and unique range of plant life, too, compared with the other islands, where greenery is perhaps in shorter supply. But that's a conversation for another day.
Oh, I see. Do explain.
Yes, well, if I could come in here. You see, there is a phenomenon called inversion, which basically means that the clouds tend to form a carpet of cover at around 1,000 meters. La Palma being the steepest island in the world, what this means is that above that altitude, and there is much terrain here at 1,000+ meters, the island is completely shielded from light pollution. That equates to perfectly dark skies, the ideal conditions for stargazing.
So it is necessary to travel to altitude to enjoy the starlit skies then, would I be right in saying?
Yes and no. On cloudy nights, the best opportunity for stargazing certainly exists at 1,000+ meters. However, in the complete absence of cloud, which is not unusual either, there are vantage points throughout the island, both at low and high altitude, which offer spectacular viewing. I guess the point to get across is that even under cloudy conditions, all is not lost here, which cannot be said of most places, and the clouds themselves can be advantageous, as already explained.
So the mountaintops are always clear, regardless of the weather at lower altitude, is that correct?
The vast majority of the time, yes. You see, the prevailing winds in this area play a part on forming the perfect conditions for inversion to take place. That means that for the majority of the year, conditions are very favourable. Occasionally, however, when the weather patterns change and winds come from a different direction, inversion does not take place below the tops, and clear skies are not guaranteed there. More often than not, though, conditions are favourable thanks to those aforementioned prevailing winds, the trade winds. So the likelihood of excellent stargazing opportunities at altitude is extremely high.
Would it be fair to say, though, that good stargazing is only possible away from habitation?
Yes, well, dark skies are essential, of course, so light pollution from towns and villages could be a potential problem. However, and this is another key factor which makes our island such a perfect astronomy location, the government has taken measures to ensure light pollution is kept to an absolute minimum.
Indeed. For example, white light is not used on the island. This is too intrusive. Lighting is required to be yellow or orange in colour. Furthermore, all street lighting, etc., points downward. This is a requirement by law, further limiting the extent of possible pollution. That is why, for instance, the area in the south of the island, around Fuencaliente, is an excellent spot for stargazing on clear nights, despite its low altitude and high population levels. Indeed, there is a huge tourist hotel at the southernmost point, yet you would hardly know it was there at all, due to the lighting policies on the island. Under normal circumstances, stargazing could not be enjoyed in such a location. But thanks to the government's commitment to maintaining dark skies, even densely populated areas of the island can make surprisingly good viewing points where they would not elsewhere.
Fascinating. And for our listeners, what tips would you give them to see?
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4 consists of two tasks. You will hear 5 short extracts in which people talk about their evening study programmes. Look at task 1. For questions 21 to 25, choose from the list A to H the reason each speaker first started their course. Now look at task 2. For questions 26 to 30, choose from the list A to H what each speaker says about their tutor. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 4. Speaker 1.
I've made lots of new friends on my evening course, and what struck me about it most is the sheer diversity of attendees, not to mention the variety of reasons why they're there. Many cite boredom. Others say it's a matter of self-development. Some are doing it to link in with an existing or prospective career. I guess maybe I fall into the latter bracket, in the sense that the possibility of one day moving into a job where I use Spanish every day definitely motivated me to join. However, perhaps more so as time has gone on, I found myself being drawn back to the lessons each week by the opportunity to interact with so many different people from so many different walks of life. Variety, as they say, is the spice of life, and it certainly makes the lessons interesting, which is just as well because, as competent as our tutor is, she is a little flat, dare I say dull.
Speaker 2.
My primary motivation for wanting to do this evening course was the fact that I'm in a new town. I would describe myself as relatively outgoing and certainly not shy, so I've no inhibitions as such to overcome. But I think it is difficult for someone when they first arrive at a new place. Most people have an established circle of friends, and it's hard to find where you fit in. What our tutor lacks in competence, though, she certainly makes up for in kindness, because she's been instrumental in helping me form a network of my own here. My new life no longer feels so daunting or lonely. So whilst my Spanish may not improve a whole lot, I won't be short of things to do at the weekend.
Speaker 3.
Virtually my entire circle of close friends has been raving about this new language course for a while. Unfortunately, they're all linguists, discounting myself. So when a famous language instructor moved to our town and started offering lessons in Spanish, they jumped at the chance. Now, it's all they ever talk about, which leaves me feeling like a spare part in our circle. So, fearing I'd be nudged out of the group completely, I decided to join up too. And while I don't exactly take to languages like a duck to water, I've been pleasantly surprised by how much I've enjoyed it, I must say. That's down in no small part to the tutor, of course, who lives up to her fame and reputation and has expertise in abundance.
Speaker 4.
Initially, my employer was going to insist on my enrolling in Spanish lessons, as the company was in talks to take over a large rival in Spain. But when those discussions fell through, the necessity to learn disappeared, as did my boss's desire to fork out the money. I had actually been against the idea at first, but I'd warmed to it over time, and was so disappointed that I put my hand in my own pocket and enrolled anyway. I'd figured it would come in handy on my vacations, as I was a frequent visitor to Latin America. I hadn't reckoned on it improving my love life, though, so it was a huge bonus when I met my soulmate at the lessons, none other than my tutor, Virginia. We're about the same age and just clicked. I credit her making me use my Spanish all the time we are together rather than the lessons specifically for how much I've improved in such a short space of time.
Speaker 5.
I'd always wanted to learn a second language. I guess, like a lot of people, it was somewhere on my to-do list, but a way down. However, my employer moved it right up to the top by announcing the head office would be relocating to Spain. They didn't make lessons compulsory, but it was pretty clear that if I wanted to continue to excel and progress in my job, I'd need to knuckle down and learn. So that is precisely why I enrolled. I've heard it said many times by fellow students that my tutor is fantastic and a very knowledgeable linguist. I've little doubt that that's so. However, for me, I think there is room in a beginner's class for the use of our native tongue and not just Spanish. I think I would have progressed more quickly in this way.
Now you will hear part 4 again. Speaker 1.
I've made lots of new friends on my evening course, and what struck me about it most is the sheer diversity of attendees, not to mention the variety of reasons why they're there. Many cite boredom. Others say it's a matter of self-development. Some are doing it to link in with an existing or prospective career. I guess maybe I fall into the latter bracket, in the sense that the possibility of one day moving into a job where I use Spanish every day definitely motivated me to join. However, perhaps more so as time has gone on, I found myself being drawn back to the lessons each week by the opportunity to interact with so many different people from so many different walks of life. Variety, as they say, is the spice of life, and it certainly makes the lessons interesting, which is just as well because, as competent as our tutor is, she is a little flat, dare I say dull.
Speaker 2.
My primary motivation for wanting to do this evening course was the fact that I'm in a new town. I would describe myself as relatively outgoing and certainly not shy, so I've no inhibitions as such to overcome. But I think it is difficult for someone when they first arrive at a new place. Most people have an established circle of friends, and it's hard to find where you fit in. What our tutor lacks in competence, though, she certainly makes up for in kindness, because she's been instrumental in helping me form a network of my own here. My new life no longer feels so daunting or lonely. So whilst my Spanish may not improve a whole lot, I won't be short of things to do at the weekend.
Speaker 3.
Virtually my entire circle of close friends has been raving about this new language course for a while. Unfortunately, they're all linguists, discounting myself. So when a famous language instructor moved to our town and started offering lessons in Spanish, they jumped at the chance. Now, it's all they ever talk about, which leaves me feeling like a spare part in our circle. So, fearing I'd be nudged out of the group completely, I decided to join up too. And while I don't exactly take to languages like a duck to water, I've been pleasantly surprised by how much I've enjoyed it, I must say. That's down in no small part to the tutor, of course, who lives up to her fame and reputation and has expertise in abundance.
Speaker 4.
Initially, my employer was going to insist on my enrolling in Spanish lessons, as the company was in talks to take over a large rival in Spain. But when those discussions fell through, the necessity to learn disappeared, as did my boss's desire to fork out the money. I had actually been against the idea at first, but I'd warmed to it over time, and was so disappointed that I put my hand in my own pocket and enrolled anyway. I'd figured it would come in handy on my vacations, as I was a frequent visitor to Latin America. I hadn't reckoned on it improving my love life, though, so it was a huge bonus when I met my soulmate at the lessons, none other than my tutor, Virginia. We're about the same age and just clicked. I credit her making me use my Spanish all the time we are together rather than the lessons specifically for how much I've improved in such a short space of time.
Speaker 5.
I'd always wanted to learn a second language. I guess, like a lot of people, it was somewhere on my to-do list, but a way down. However, my employer moved it right up to the top by announcing the head office would be relocating to Spain. They didn't make lessons compulsory, but it was pretty clear that if I wanted to continue to excel and progress in my job, I'd need to knuckle down and learn. So that is precisely why I enrolled. I've heard it said many times by fellow students that my tutor is fantastic and a very knowledgeable linguist. I've little doubt that that's so. However, for me, I think there is room in a beginner's class for the use of our native tongue and not just Spanish. I think I would have progressed more quickly in this way.
That is the end of part 4. In the actual test, there would now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. The examiner shall remind you when there's 1 minute left, so that you're sure to finish in time.